Mike Pence inserts himself in the national immigration debate. What's the motive? The governor takes his sales pitch for HIP 2.0 to Washington. Joe Donnelly on the VA audit in Indianapolis and a pair of bad sheriffs have something in common. That plus beer restrictions at the state fair, a train scare, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 1, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, Governor Mike Pence wrote a letter to the president objecting to the fact that 245 immigrant children were placed in Indiana by the federal government this year, and state government received no notification. He said states should not be forced to deal with a failed national immigration policy. He later took that message to a national audience on Fox News.
What we ought to be doing is humanely processing these children and families and returning them to their home countries, reuniting them with their families.
Why did Mike Pence insert himself in the immigration debate? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, is the governor right about the need for federal notification?
No. I mean, we had the airlift of Cuban children in, what, the early 60s, and nothing was said about that at that time. And the irony of this is that this doesn't impose any burden on the state. These children are going to live with relatives. They're not in state foster homes. We don't have a location for them here where they're being placed.
90% plus, I'm told,
are going to existing
family.
Relatives, families in this country, some of whom, by the way, are the parents of these children. The irony of this is that this entire problem was created by legislation for which, guess what? Mike Pence voted. Okay? He voted for the legislation that created the problem that required them to have these hearings. And now, of course, they won't pass a sensible immigration policy. Republican House will not do it. And then they just wring their hands.
They're about to go on recess, and they haven't been able to come to an agreement on one, mostly because of Republican infighting. What is Mike Pence trying to help out the House Speaker here?
Mike Pence is a governor of a state that should not have the federal government putting people in the state without any notification whatsoever. I mean, it's just crazy. The way to stop having 57,000 illegal immigrants coming into this country is to make sure that they go back to where they came. And they ought to do it humanely as they possibly can, but they need to do it. Because what you're doing by perpetuating this, you're perpetuating the traffickers who have this business of bringing these kids hundreds, if not thousands of miles, where they're either walking or driving, sometimes with very inhumane conditions. And by having them stay in this country and placing them throughout the United States, you're encouraging that business to continue. And you can't do that. You can't have borders where it's so porous that anybody who wants to walk in the door can't. I mean, we've got to stop it now, because if you don't, you're going to continue to have this happen over and over
and over
again.
You need an immigration policy.
I agree.
The House will not deal with
it. It's not the House,
Anne. It is
the
House.
It's the Senate together.
It's the House.
Right now, the Senate put a bill together for $17 billion.
And what you're saying, Mike, ignores the fact.
And they put a bill together for $17 billion that also paid for a whole lot of other things that don't have anything to do with immigration. They throw it out there and they say, okay, if you want it, you've got to have these things.
The House rules pass.
Well, back to Mike Pence. This is a relatively small problem in Indiana, 245 kids. Maryland's gotten 2,000, another 2,000 on the way. Why is he getting so much attention?
It's an IQ test.
Clearly, Mike Pence is someone who has been a high-profile leader in the conservative portion of the Republican Party. He think back to some of the straw polls with conservative PAC, where he emerged as, this was several years ago, of course, as a standard bearer, perhaps, for the party. And a lot of people, he's a communicator.
He's running for president. That's why.
Well, it takes two to tango,
though. I mean, there's an interest in hearing from him. There are other Republican governors, I think, who have authored letters and signed on to letters, about a half dozen or so.
Ten, right.
But he's the one who he's oft quoted, and that's that he is a communicator, and I'm sure they have his phone number if they want comment, and vice versa.
So is he just doing his job?
Well, he's registering his opinion about it, and it's, you know, he's the governor of the state, so I suppose that's the case. But no, he's running for president, and he's working his contacts and his connections in Washington, D.C. He happened to be in the city to talk with the Health and Human Services director, so he was available in studio. He was doing what he's doing, and that's running for president, and, you know.
Either running for president or keeping
Keeping the name out there. Right,
which,
in the four.
Right.
Because those other governors sign letters, Mike Pence is able to get
correct
on Fox News.
Right.
All right. While in Washington, as you said, Governor Pence met with HHS Secretary Sylvia Burwell about his plans to expand the Healthy Indiana Plan. The governor issued a statement that says, quote, differences remain over the plan that is a Medicaid expansion by another name. That plan, called HIP 2.0, could expand health insurance coverage to 400,000 people in Indiana. It was unveiled in May and requires federal approval. This was the governor's first meeting with Sylvia Burwell, but he's talked to her on the phone previously and met with her predecessor, Kathleen Sebelius. There is no timeline for federal approval, but the Pence administration would like to implement the plan in early 2015. Mike McDaniel, did he expect to get a green light on that visit?
I don't think he expected it on this visit, but I think they are confident they're going to get it done before the end of the year. And I think they will get it implemented by early next year. They've made a lot of progress. He also said, which you didn't say there in your lead-in, that the meeting went well. That was the first quote he had when he came out of there. But there's still differences. And so they're still continuing to negotiate what those differences are. But I think, based on what I've heard about the situation, that they're going to get a deal made before the end of the year.
His plan involves co-pays and, for some people, health savings accounts. You think that's where the hang-up might be?
I think that may be the hang-up, yes, because my understanding is that they can be changed in which program they're on if they don't do the co-pay, but they can't be eliminated. If there's give and take on this, and I assume that the governor, since he's put all his eggs in this basket, is willing to negotiate rather than take his usual my way or the highway stance, then they should come to an agreement on this, because so much is at stake. I've said that before. I don't care what he calls it or anything else. I want those hundreds of thousands of people to have health insurance. I think it's important for the state.
But he has said that he would be willing to walk away if he doesn't get those provisions that he calls consumer-driven health care.
And, of course, that's part of any negotiation, but I think he really runs a huge risk if he walks away, and that's why I think that they are so involved with Health and Human Services to try to get this done, because neither side really wants it to fail. I think they both want the additional coverage. They both have a lot of reasons, including some that are political, and so I think they want to get it done. But he has to say that. He has to give the impression he's got some leverage.
And by the time the negotiations are done, and if once a deal is struck, and it probably will be some sort of deal, I presume it'll still be called HIP 2.0, but it'll probably be something closer to 2.5 or 3.0, because clearly there seems to be some willingness to change on the co-pays, on the thresholds, so that it's a much smaller percentage of the pool of Hoosiers who would, in fact, have to pay these requirements. And if the administration in D.C. is willing to bless what's called, you know, HIP 2.0 and give Indiana something to crow about, even if, as a practical matter, it effectively gets to the same place as a traditional Medicaid expansion would have, then everybody goes home happy. And
they've blessed other names. I mean, Kentucky's goes by a different name.
Well,
I think the name is not relevant.
No, I'm not talking about the name as much.
Clearly, there are differences.
There are changes.
There are at least five significant differences between this and traditional Medicaid.
But if they're negotiating in good faith, that five ought to get down to one or two, and it ought to be resolved.
It will be.
Moving on, three Indiana Veterans Administration facilities were red flagged in a report by the Inspector General. One is the Rodebush Medical Center in Indianapolis. This week, Senator Joe Donnelly was briefed on the audit. It cited claims by a union president that appointments were manipulated, but Donnelly says the red flag may be undeserved.
We have heard from the folks who helped to manage the Rodebush facility and work for our VA, for all of our veterans. They said, this has not happened. And so it's possible that it's not deserved, but our obligation is to find out one way or the other.
John Katzenberger, how confusing is that?
It is confusing, and it's frustrating for people who want a couple of things to happen, get to the bottom of the problems that occurred, and get the services to the veterans who need them. And you have this back and forth, and part of this comes from a survey that was administered to the employees, and the employees are self-reporting themselves. And then you have a whistleblower who says, well, wait, they weren't using the system they should have been using. They were using other systems. And you've got this back and forth. Until we get this resolved, it's going to be difficult to not be confused and to not be frustrated by it. So far, the politics has stayed out of this. And I hope, let me take that back. The overt and the leveraged politics has stayed out of this, and I hope it doesn't get to that. But the longer this goes along like this and the more confusing it becomes, the more likely that will happen.
Yeah. In the meantime, Congress passed a bill to help solve many of the VA's problems this week. Everybody in the Indiana congressional delegation seems to be very interested in making the VA work.
Oh, of course. I think, as John suggests, this is one of those issues. If ever there were an area where we might see bipartisan cooperation, it's this one. Because it is a payback, if you will, to people who have given of their time and risked their lives to defend what we hold dear. So that doesn't, though, divorce this issue from politics, because it is a strong political narrative about which side turned their collective backs on veterans. So you're right. It's been a very careful dance thus far. Nobody has been willing to, we both offer a lot of caveats. There hasn't been a lot of overt accusations.
Well,
the question is, can that remain?
Apparently there are some labor management issues out there.
If there are in any institution.
Well, I think that's probably right. This red flag has caused a couple of Congress members, Susan Brooks and Jackie Walorski, to come pay a visit. Right. It raised a lot of issues, and it's kind of thrown in the public perception the Indianapolis facility in the same boat as the Phoenix facility, and it appears that there are huge differences.
Well, I mean, I don't think that people see this the same way that they see the Phoenix facility. I think there's an accusation that's been made by the union president involved, but I don't think anybody sees it to the extent that was reported in Phoenix. And so the question is, how prevalent was it? How often did it happen? And both Senator Donnelly and Representative Walorski both basically said the same thing this week when they both said, we're going to drill down to the bottom of this till we get to the facts, because it's important that we move forward on that. I think the bill that passed this week with bipartisan support that says if you're more than 30 days or you're more than 40 miles from a facility,
you can go into the
money,
private
you go
system
ahead and use the system,
VA
which
will
is what
pay
we've
for
been
it.
Talking about here for weeks, I think was a great piece of legislation and something that's well overdue. So
it also,
I think we're
it
headed,
also calls for building 27 new facilities.
And I think we're headed towards the time when these things will be behind us, but it's just going to take some more time to sort it out.
Yeah, some of the problem obviously is based on the fact that we've been at war for 10 years, and we have so many veterans in this situation, and the expansion capacity for the VAs is not kept up, nor, by the way, have the salaries for the VA employees, and they're struggling to hire doctors and nurses because they are underpaying them. So we've got to do that. I hope when they go on the private sector that they can get an appointment with a GP in 30 days, because many of us can't do that. So, I mean, you've got all those considerations. But I think it's important here. There was an allegation made by the union president. We don't know if there was any evidence that supported that allegation. Senator Donnelly went there and was very impressed with the facilities and is worried because he doesn't want the vast majority of people there that are working very hard under tough conditions to provide the services to get demoralized polarized by these
kinds of things.
And
most of the reviews are good.
Most of the reviews are good. And independent of that, the American Hospital Association has cited the Rauterbusch Center with a letter of commendation, and it's the only VA hospital in the country to get such a letter. So they're obviously doing a good job. Could they do better if they had more personnel? Absolutely, because the demand is high. So I think they're doing the right thing, and I think that legislation passed with bipartisan support, as Mike points out, is a great step in the right direction to provide those services.
Nice to see Congress getting together on something.
On something.
Clark County Sheriff Danny Rodden is indicted on 8 federal charges stemming from allegations involving a prostitute. It comes just weeks after Boone County Sheriff Ken Campbell resigned after his 4-year relationship with a prostitute was exposed, reportedly the same woman Rodden was involved with. Authorities arrested Rodden this week. He was brought to Indianapolis to face the charges and has been released pending his next court date. His attorney, Larry Wilder, addressed the charges.
He was just very distraught about what has happened and certainly wants to do everything that's right and everything that is right for the community and everything that's right for his family and everything that is right that is what he believes in his heart should be done to make things right.
John Schwanis, what does this do for the reputation of county sheriffs?
Anytime you have situations like these, allegations like these come to light, where it involves apparently moral lapses and beyond, it can't help but erode some of the confidence that people have in their elected officials. I mean, these are the individuals who are ostensibly the ranking law enforcement officers in their given counties. They ask people to throw their support to these individuals at the ballot box. And it's just disappointing. You hate anything that one of our themes we often talk about is people who say, I'm just fed up with government at all levels, you know, everybody's crooked. And this, you regret to see these kinds of things play into that narrative.
This case in Clark County seems to be much more serious. It involves giving her a uniform in one case and payment for services that we didn't hear about in Boone County. I mean, it's getting worse.
Well, yeah, it's terrible as it is, and you're right, it is getting worse. Part of it may be that the sheriff in Boone County resigned, and this sheriff didn't until he was arrested. It may not have resigned. I don't know what his status is at this point. So, you know, the process grinds on with him, and maybe more of these details will surface. But hopefully it ends here, and the problems that John talked about can be alleviated, and everybody else can get on with the rest of their business.
Every sheriff in Indiana is either leaving office or on the ballot this year. Will this hurt incumbents?
I don't think it'll hurt incumbents that aren't involved in it. I think in many communities the sheriff is known and admired and liked. And I don't necessarily think because you have 2 bad apples in that gigantic tub that it means the rest of them are contaminated, but there really isn't anything good you can say about Clark County.
Yeah, I mean, 2 out of 92.
Yeah. Let's hope that's all there is. Yes.
Your take?
Well, I mean, it's been said here already, but in most of the 92 counties, the sheriff's the highest profile elected official in the county, usually the most well known. And it does soil the reputation of that office, but I do think it's an individual county-by-county basis because most people know these sheriffs or think they know these sheriffs pretty well. And this is tragic because what it does to these families, what it does to these communities is not good, and it hurts everybody.
Any chance that this will lead to a call to make a sheriff an appointed position?
No. No way in Indiana.
How does the fact that he's appointed or elected affect this?
No.
It gives him freedom that you might not have otherwise.
To do more of this?
To do what you want, and in these cases, it's not a good thing.
It's not very good. You can't.
I agree with Ann. I'm not sure where you're going with it.
we've seen scandals involving statewide offices where immediately there's a call to make them appointed positions rather than elected.
Uh-huh.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we had another scandal this week where we had the whitewash office clear another scandal in the administration statewide. So, you know, it's you can't legislate or appoint judgment. Either people have it or they don't, okay? And you cannot possibly legislate against every possible wrongdoing. We've seen that with the state administration but time and time again.
I guess maybe the answer is this is why they have elections.
That may be.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, do the recent accusations against two sheriffs affect your opinion of law enforcement officers? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, is Mike Pence delivering on his promise to make jobs the top priority in his administration? 21% said yes, 63% said no, 16% said it's too early to tell. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. The Indiana State Fair opened this week, and the most talked about new attraction is the beer hall. Indiana craft beers will be on sale in Grand Hall across from the Coliseum from 1 in the afternoon to 8 in the evening every day of the fair. You can also buy wine from Indiana wineries. Fairgoers must be 21 years old to get in. They are limited to 3 beers or 3 glasses of wine each, and they can't take it outside the hall.
So we want them to interact with the wineries and the craft brewers who are going to be here every day of the fair. Ask them how they get their beers to taste this way versus that way and what they like best and the whole process.
State Fair spokesman Andy Klotz there. And Delaney, are those restrictions necessary?
Necessary for what? I mean, necessary for the politics of introducing alcohol to the state fair?
Reintroducing,
that's right.
Since 1946,
yes.
Right.
Okay, stand corrected. Thank you, John. But the fact of the matter is that's why these are happening. I mean, you know, they could regulate the size of the cup or what the cup is made out of or what chairs you sit in. I mean, it's all done to help assuage the negative feelings of people who don't think they should be there. That's all.
Still some irony in the fact that outside of the 2 weeks of the fair, you can buy as many beers as you want on the state fairgrounds at any event that's taking place there. Is there not?
Well, I mean, I think Ann's partially right about this, the idea
only
that...
Only partially?
Well, no, because yes, only partially, because I think this has traditionally been a big agricultural event. It's got its roots in 4-H, which involve a lot of young people. I mean, there's a lot of heritage there that you've got to ease into these kinds of things, and this was a long time coming. I mean, you got to remember that this idea had been shot down on several occasions, and it's finally happened. And they're going out of their way to make sure that there are no problems with this. They got security inside, outside. Everybody's going to be carded. You know, restricted hours, how many you can have. I mean, it's the equivalent of about 2.5 beers, I think, total of what you can have. And so, you know, it's good because this industry's growing. We're the last state in the union to do this.
And there's talk that they'll loosen up in the future. There might be a second beer hall. They might lift some of the restrictions.
One would presume. I think this is...
You can't walk around the fairgrounds with it.
Right.
I think the notion that it is, because it's been away since 1946, there are those who think that the state fair is not the appropriate place. It just takes a while to ease back in. Pretty soon, who knows, maybe it'll be deep fried and rolled in sugar like everything else in the fair. And then we'll know all the handcuffs are off.
The beauty about that comment, John, is that there are brewers in this state who might try to figure out a way to do that. Because this is a very vibrant industry in Indiana. And it's great that they get a chance to play on this stage because people should know about this. This is a great business, both on the beer side and the wine side, and soon on the distilled spirit side.
Sounds like you've done some research.
I work at that a little bit.
He's made sacrifice.
You know? Yes, that's exactly right.
You going to the fair, John?
I've already been to the fair, Jim.
Today?
I went this morning, yeah.
Good for you. It's three beers each time you go.
No beer sales till 1. All right, finally, two women barely escaped being hit by a train near Bloomington this week. A camera captured the moment when the women were walking along a 80-foot high bridge when the train approached. The Indiana Railroad says the engineer hit the emergency brakes, but the two had to fall to the ground between the rails and let the 100-car, 14,000-ton train pass over them. The train crossed the bridge before coming to a complete stop. Eric Powell of the Indiana Railroad Company.
They crawled out from under the freight cars, ran towards the end of the bridge. You know, the engineer was he was shaken up, but he asked them if they were okay. One of them yelled that she had stubbed her toe, but otherwise fine.
Mike McDaniel, who's luckier, those two women or the guy who won $1 million in the Hoosier lottery for a second time this week?
These two women. I mean, this is an incredible situation they got out of there with their lives. What was the clearance?
7 inches.
I'd be twins if I were. And this is not good. I mean, this is so dangerous. And I hope a lot of young people who've seen this video know how dangerous this is, because you can't risk your life doing this kind of thing.
They deserve to be prosecuted for trespassing?
I think they probably had the scare of their lives, and I probably will not do it again, but they risked their lives in this endeavor. And, you know, then you get the Suleiman family, for example, who were risking their lives flying around the world to raise money for schools in Pakistan, and they weren't as lucky. And it just doesn't seem sometimes very fair.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.